You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, we are now hearing the true story of the election. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, Mitt Romney says it is clear it was all those gifts to black people that President Obama was promising and offering and had given. And in fact, a little bit later on the show, we will play a clip from the head of the Republican Party in Maine, who is pointing out that dozens of black people voted in Maine. And he thinks that's very suspicious, very suspicious. But does all this mean, now that the president is the president still, or will be for another 4 years, President Obama, does this mean that we are moving into a new era in the United States, that we are on the edge of losing our liberty, that mind control techniques are being used against us by the United States and by President Obama? Field Searcy is with us. He's a conservative activist, co-founder of the Georgia Tea Party. In Defense of Liberty.tv is his website. Field, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. Tennessee and Kentucky, Tennessee and Kansas have already passed resolutions through their state legislatures, basically affirming your perspective, which you shared with the Georgia Republican Party a month ago, that between the UN Agenda 21 and President Obama, something's rotten in Denmark, to badly paraphrase Shakespeare. Tell us about it.
Well, not only those two states, but Alabama as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Tom, this is really, it's not a left or right, a Republican or Democratic issue. This is something that's been going on for probably 20 years or more. And it's been a program adopted by George H.W. Bush when he signed the Rio Summit Treaty in 92. And it was further promoted by Bill Clinton when he created the Council of Sustainable Development. And there are people on both sides, you know, there are Democrats out in California that are fighting this as well because of loss of property rights. Rosa Corey, she's written the book Behind the Green Mask. She's a Democrat.
Yeah, but see, none of this has to do with Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is non-binding. It's an advisory thing. But I'm curious, and we can get into that in some detail, but, you know, the word mind control pops out. What is this Delphi technique that the president is using to control our minds?
Well, I never said that President Obama was using the Delphi technique to do anything.
Oh, then the UN is using it?
I'm sorry?
What was the warning to the Georgia legislators? Who is using this technique?
The Delphi technique is a method of facilitated consensus,
right,
that is being used in visioning and consensus-building workshops all over the country to develop comprehensive plans for local communities. And the technique is they've already decided what it is they want to do with the zoning or plans for the community.
Right.
But they want to attempt to show that they're getting public input. And the Delphi technique is to basically, if anyone objects to the plans, that person is marginalized or ostracized if they, you know, become belligerent, obviously, with the facilitator. Facilitators in these consensus meetings, a lot of times they're hired. They are not elected officials of the county that's holding these meetings.
Right.
And they're the ones that are using the Delphi technique.
Now, I watched the video. Actually, I didn't have time to watch the whole thing, but I watched the first part of the video on your website, indefenseofliberty.tv. And in which you were talking about this, you started out by talking about these women who were arrested for growing gardens. And it reminded me that back in the 80s, when Louise and I owned an ad agency, we owned a travel agency there too, but in the years that we owned an ad agency in Atlanta, we moved into a rather upscale neighborhood up in Roswell on a little lake, and which had its own homeowners association. And I remember sitting in on the meeting where they decided you can't grow vegetables in your front yard. And which seemed crazy to me. We'd spent a year in Germany back in the 80s, and everybody grows vegetables in their front yard and their backyard because they all remember the famines after World War II, and or remember the stories about them. This was promoted by our neighborhood association as a way of, you know, they also passed a regulation that if you wanted to paint the color of your house, you had to get approval of the homeowners association. What does that have to do with the United Nations?
Well, the United Nations policies are being adopted even at the local level. In the Cobb County Comprehensive Plan, the county where I live.
Well, I lived in Cobb County. That's where we lived, in Roswell, Georgia.
Yeah, and on page 185 of that comprehensive plan, it says that Cobb County will promote sustainable development policies as prescribed by the United Nations Sustainable Development Plan.
Okay.
And this is a 300-page document that has all sorts of controls on not only our land use, but our food, our water. And
but
I'm saying that if our county commissioners are adopting these policies, they need to have read that 300-page UN document and fully vetted all the provisions in that document. And they're signing our citizens onto this. It's being done at the local level.
Right.
It's being done at the state level, and it's being done at the national level. It's not being done by the United Nations. It's
being done by our own elected officials. If Agenda 21 was adopted by Cobb County, then in Lock Highland, the neighborhood I used to live in, then people would be able to grow gardens, vegetables in their front yard because, you know, the UN is suggesting that people should be more self-sufficient and, you know, be able to grow their own vegetables.
Got no problem with that as long as we have the freedom to do that. But there are other provisions in the sustainable development that seek to limit property rights and reduce property values by taking property rights through downzoning. And this is a violation of our Fifth Amendment to right.
What is downzoning?
Downzoning means if I have, let me give you an example. In Habersham County in Georgia, their comprehensive plan was presented 2 months ago, and one of the local citizens found out they were going to restrict building single-family homes on a minimum of 30 acres. So if you had a piece of property and the county approves this plan,
right,
that you couldn't develop that property for 10 lots. You could only put one house on it.
Yeah, that's, so you know, those kind of things are happening all over the country, and they got nothing to do with the UN. When I was living in Georgia or in Oregon, there was in one of the rural counties, I'm forgetting the name of the county, but it's a big wine growing area. And, you know, the people there were freaked out that developers were coming in and buying, you know, a single winery, which might be 300-400 acres, and turning it into 10,000 homes or thousands of homes. And the consequence of that was that they were sucking up all the local water table. They were producing pollution and noise and traffic, and all these local farmers were really, really upset about it. And so they went in and forbid it by zoning. Isn't that local government doing what it's supposed to do, the will of the people who live there?
Well, if the people know, that's what's happening. But this is everything to do with sustainable development, and these plans are being implemented all over the country.
What's wrong with sustainable?
Nothing is wrong with sustainable, as long as it's not a political agenda, okay?
And well, how can you do anything that's not, if you're going to do anything through a political process, how can it not be a political agenda?
Well, if it's a political agenda for to control society, social justice, you can read the quotes from these people that develop these plans.
So you're opposed to social justice?
Property is not sustainable. It needs to be in government control.
Right. So you're opposed to sustainability and social justice?
I'm not opposed to sustainable development as long as private property rights are preserved, as long as individual liberty is preserved, as long as our freedoms are preserved.
So if those two things come into conflict, if you own some property and all your neighbors think that the way you're developing it is really ruining the neighborhood, who should win? You think you should, right?
I think there should be a balance there. I mean, obviously, you can't do something that your property is going to damage other people's property.
Yeah.
Likewise, they shouldn't take value away from you.
Typically, that's what zoning's all about. But I get your point. People can read all about it at indefenseofliberty.tv. Field Searcy, thanks, Field, for dropping by today.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So is the Obama administration and the UN using the Delphi mind control technique on us? Find out more. Ah, but you're going to get it anyway.
No dark sarcasm in the classroom.
Maybe we'll get that, too. I don't know. But at least in the county zoning commission meetings, you're going to get somebody exercising mind control on behalf of the UN's Agenda 21. Don't you know? Meanwhile, big problems in Maine. They have figured out why it is that President Obama won Maine and Mitt Romney lost. Because in the rural areas of Maine, dozens of black people voted. Oh, I am not making this up. Let us turn to the senior Republican official in the great state of Maine. This is, where did his name go? Webster, Charlie Webster. He's the chairman of Maine's Republican Party. He was on a local radio show or TV show this morning. And here's the interview with him where he describes what happened.
I'm going to do a mailing right off. In some parts of the state, there were, for example, in some parts of rural Maine, there were dozens of black people who came in to vote at election day.
Dozens!
Everybody has a right to vote. But nobody in town knows anybody's black. How did that happen? I don't know. We're going to find out. I think it's a problem.
Where did that happen?
In several rural Maine towns. What I'm doing is I'm purchasing a postcard. We're going to mail it in and thank people for registering a vote and see where that comes back.
Yeah, so we're going to try some caging here to see if we can catch these people. Thank you for registering to vote. And if it comes back as no such address, then we'll know. These were black people bussed in from Massachusetts to vote. Right? It had to be. There you go. Thank you, Shana. No, I'm serious. This is not some crackpot in Maine. This is the head of the Maine Republican Party saying there's something up. Dozens of black people voted in Maine voted. We don't even know who they voted for, but they voted. Question immediately comes to my mind. If the Democrats wanted to sneak people into Maine, mostly white Maine, to secretly vote dozens of people. If the Democrats wanted to sneak dozens of people into lily white Maine to vote for Obama, why would they pick black people? Aren't there plenty of white people in Massachusetts who are Obama supporters who could just as easily have been bussed into Maine to vote? And then everybody would be sitting around going, oh, it all look like white people to me. I don't see any problem. I mean, just think about this for a minute. The whole proposition. The presumption that's behind this. This is a variation on, you know, what Romney said yesterday in this conference call with his financial supporters, saying, well, you know, it's all these gifts that Obama gave out, you know, student loans, reduction in the interest rate on student loans. That's a big gift to students. Of course, they're going to vote for him. And health care, he said, you know, family making $30,000 a year, getting free health care, that's worth $10,000 a year. That's a big gift. In fact, here's Mitt Romney in his own words.
What the president's campaign did was focus on certain members of his base coalition, give them extraordinary financial gifts from the government, and then work very aggressively to turn them out to vote.
Yeah, here's another one.
What the president did is he gave them two things. One, he gave them a big gift on immigration with the DREAM Act amnesty program. Number two, put in place Obamacare, which basically is $10,000 a family. I mean, it's a proven political strategy, which is give a bunch of money from the government to a group, and guess what? They'll vote for you.
Yeah, older people, Social Security, they'll vote for you. Young people, college educations, they'll vote for you. Healthcare to everybody, they'll vote for you. What I'm wondering is what's wrong with giving that to people? I mean, aren't these things that we should be doing? Oh, and speaking of gifts, Mr. Romney, what about the 20% tax cut that you were offering to the billionaires? Is that not a gift? I would think a 20% tax cut on, you know, one of the Wall Street guys who makes $2 billion a year, that's $400 million a year as a tax cut. $400 million to one guy. Now, there's at least a dozen guys on Wall Street who earned over $2 billion last year. or the year before last, the last number of the year that we have statistics for. So you got a dozen guys making more than $2 billion. You're offering each one of them a $400 million tax cut. Well, it actually wouldn't be a $400 million tax cut. It would be 20% of what they pay in taxes, which is very little. So it's probably more like $10 or $20 or $30 million. But still, you add all that up and you get $100 or $200 or $300 million in tax cuts. And that's just for the dozen guys on Wall Street, you know, in Wall Street who are making a billion. The top traders, that's not a gift. I mean, couldn't we use that same money to pay for health care and to pay for college educations? And oh, but we don't do that for the little people. Leona Helmsley told us that. Only the little people pay taxes. Yes. Consider the mindset here. I'm serious. Think about the mindset. This is a man born a multimillionaire, representing a party, the Republican Party, that stands for the interests and has since the 1870s, stands for the interests of multimillionaires and billionaires. And they're looking down on the rest of us going, oh, isn't that interesting? They want to have old age poverty insurance, Social Security. They want to have health care. They want their children to go to school. Can you imagine the lower classes wanting their children to go to school? For free, no less. Now, we had to pay $60,000 a year to send Mitt through Cranbrook or whatever the... Cranbrook is where George W. Bush went. I don't remember which academy Mitt went through. We had to pay $60,000 a year to send our son through. Just, I mean, this is mind-boggling.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So on the one hand, you've got the UN's Agenda 21, and I've got a caller saying it's come to Michigan. And on the other hand, you got Mitt Romney going, oh, yeah, it's all about goodies. I got to tell you about Jude Winiski. Agenda 21 being promoted across the United States. Sustainable development as recommended by the United Nations. Speed of mind control. Pizza does that to my cat. It's definitely a mind control device. No doubt about it. And, in fact, we had pizza a couple nights ago, and Higgins went nuts. But Papa John's is saying, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, we're going to have to raise the cost of our pizzas like, you know, a dime, maybe 15 cents to pay for health care for our employees. We can't have that all. It's going to be the end of the world. A fellow by the name of Martin, I'm assuming that's his last name. I just have a clip from the story here. This over Democratic Underground, it's pointing to a HuffPost story. Martin, a part owner of Ian's Pizza. This is a pizza shop with four locations in Wisconsin. Says his business has offered full health care coverage to its 50 full-time employees for years. Now, the result of that he's been offering, you know, health insurance to all of his employees is that, you know, he charges that extra 10 or 15 cents per pizza. So he said... He told Huffington Post, he said, this may level the playing field for us. If they have to pay for benefits and that pushes their prices up close to ours, it will justify what we've been paying for and what we've been fighting to do in the past few years. So, gee, Obamacare is going to allow small and medium-sized companies to compete against giants like Papa John, transnational corporations? How terrible. It's terrible, I'm telling you. It should be repealed on day one. Just ask Mitt Romney. Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. As soon as you found that you had that guy on talking about Agenda 21, I had to call because I know your parents are buried here in Charlevoix, Michigan.
Yes, they are.
And that's where I first heard about this so-called Agenda 21.
Whoa.
The local paper here, the Petoskey News Review, about two or three weeks ago, at the very bottom on the front page, there was this big, bold headline that says, Charlevoix County Commissioners thwart UN plot.
thwart UN plot?
Yes.
Charlevoix County Commission? This is the town my mom grew up in. This is incredible.
You know, and generally a headline is very short, but they went to the trouble to make a headline that was very long and it went across the whole bottom of the page.
Wow.
Well, anyway, when I first saw the headline, I was actually kind of excited myself because I'd actually like to see our Constitution replaced with a UN Charter for Human Rights. But anyway, I went on to read the article, and the first item of business that evening was, a resolution that was unanimously passed by these fools to, you know, prevent the UN from taking property rights from the city of Charlevoix or Charlevoix citizens, and basically all this razzmatazz about defending property rights and preventing the UN from taking over Charlevoix.
Right.
And, I mean, these people have to be out of their minds. But the commissioner that introduced this was apparently had been in contact ahead of time with somebody from the Republican state legislature here. So, I mean, this is a statewide effort to kind of, I don't know what.
Well,
you know,
three states have already passed resolutions now. Did he say Alabama or Mississippi was the third one? Alabama, thank you, Shano. And Tennessee and Kansas have already passed resolutions. Republicans have passed them in their legislatures saying we don't want no mind control in Agenda 21. And Georgia, you know, the secret meeting for the Georgia legislators was to introduce the PowerPoint presentation about how they're going to. You know, the UN is taking over our country, don't you know? I'm frankly far more concerned about the World Trade Organization because they actually are taking over our country. So, you know.
Well, I'm worried about Morse corporations and as far as these whining.
That's what I'm talking about.
Right-wing business owners that can't make it on their own. I'd like to actually see the municipalities, you know, seize their assets and take them over and run them as worker-owned companies if these rich wine, you know, crybabies can't make it on their own.
This is amazing. I'm looking at the article in the Petoskey News that you're talking about here, Matt. Local officials take a stand against alleged UN plot. It's by Abra Co. And it starts out smart growth, clustered development, bike paths, conservation, mixed-use zoning. What do these things have in common? They are all allegedly part of a United Nations plot to steal basic liberties from everyday citizens right here in northern Michigan. It may sound absurd, but on October 24th, the Charlevoix County Board of Commissioners voted unanimously. Commissioner Bob Drebstreet was absent to adopt a resolution opposing a 20-year-old United Nations document and agreed to reject its radical policies and any grant monies attached to it. Right.
Can you believe it?
Let me
ask you something. I'll let you go, Tom. Do you think these people seriously believe this, or is just kind of a way to drum up support and take a shot at the Democrats or the liberals or Obama? Do you think they really believe this nonsense? And I'll let you go.
I think that there is a paranoid mindset that is part human nature and part some people are just far more paranoid than others that is more than willing to believe that somebody, you know, things aren't going well and therefore somebody out there must be pulling the strings because it ain't me doing it. You know what I mean? And in bad times, in hard times, this identifying somebody as the other and blaming them. I mean, the steroids version example of it, of course, is the Protocol of the Elders of Zion and the whole anti-Semitic thing that came out of the Russian Revolution. That was a document put together by the Russian Secret Service, apparently, at the time. And that then, or at least so the stories go, and that was then used by Hitler to justify the genocide of the Jews. I mean, that's that. So, yeah, I think that there is a paranoid worldview that all too often takes hold. I remember when I was 11 or 12 years old, my dad took me to a John Birch Society in Lansing. John Birch Society meeting in Lansing. And one of the guys there gave me a copy of John Stormer's book, None Dare Call It Treason. And I read this book about all the communists who had taken over the State Department, and I was horrified. I mean, I was just horrified. It's like they're very convincing, these guys. They're very convincing. Mike in Roanoke, Virginia. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
I was wanting to make two points. One, you commented that you're giving a gift to rich people if you give them a tax break. You can't give somebody a gift that they already have. In other words, they should be thanking you for not taking more of their money, number one.
Well, hang on just a second here, Mike. If you walk into a 7-Eleven and you pick up a Hershey bar and you take a big bite out of it, Is that your Hershey bar, or is it 7-Eleven's?
That's 7-Eleven. This is money they earn.
Okay, so at that point, as soon as you've taken a bite out of that Hershey bar, you owe 7-Eleven a dollar for it, right?
Well, whatever they're charging, I guess.
Okay, yeah, let's say it's a buck, you know, just for the sake of argument. So if somebody is making, you know, tens, hundreds, thousands of millions of dollars a year here in the United States, and more than half of our court systems are used by businesses, not for criminal purposes, and our laws and legislative efforts, the vast majority of them don't have to do with crimes, they have to do with business, and our banking system is propped up and funded and regulated by all of us through our tax dollars, and those people made their money, you know, manufacturing goods and services that were transported over our highways that we all pay for, and, you know, put into stores that we all protect with our fire departments and our police departments, and then you get the companies like, you know, GE or, you know, some of the Coke operations where they pay no income taxes at all. Isn't that the same thing when rich people use the commons that heavily to make all that money, and then they say, yeah, but because I'm Mitt Romney, I'm only going to pay 14% income tax. You know, if you're a surgeon, you know, saving people's lives, you pay 36% income tax. But if you're the real rich in the United States, nah, it's just, you know, Warren Buffett, 14%. Isn't that the same thing as taking a bite out of that chocolate bar, using the commons to get rich, and then saying, you know, I'm not going to pay for this thing?
They're already paying taxes. They're already paying 70%. Of the tax bill
in
the country. And also,
no, they're not.
Yeah, those are fine.
No, they're not.
And also,
they're not even close to that. The income tax revenue, first of all, I'm not sure which they you're talking about. If you're talking about the top 5%, then we're talking about people who are making $200,000 a year. That's not the rich. That's still the high end of the middle class. And I know that, Hannity and Limbaugh love to use those numbers, and there's an old saying about liars and figures, but the fact of the matter is that people, I guess enough said. Your next point. I interrupted you.
Well, I'll move on about the tax. But anyway, about the health care, sure. I would love for everybody to have health care. It's just not, we're $16 trillion in debt. This is going to cost the country a lot more, just like Social Security, just like Medicare, Medicaid, which are all in the red.
Social Security's not in the red.
Well, I'll put it to you this way.
Social Security has a $2.5 trillion surplus, which is why Pete Peterson has spent $500 million over the last decade trying to get his grubby little hands on it.
Well, why do they keep saying it's going bankrupt by 2021? And that's
because they're hallucinating. 2021, actually it's 2024 or 27, Social Security will be able to pay 80% of what it's paying out now, not 100%, and it'll be that way for the next 100 years. And if you simply said right now, you only pay Social Security taxes on the first $110,000 of income. If you simply said everybody has to pay Social Security taxes on all of their income, in other words, people like Mitt Romney, who made $20 million last year, he only paid Social Security taxes on the first $110,000. If he had to pay Social Security taxes on the other $19.9 million that he made, then Social Security would be solvent forever. Similarly with Medicaid, or Medicare, rather, you know, the Republicans, the Bush administration put in this rule that said that Medicare, when they pay for drugs, they have to pay the full $5 an aspirin pill, the full retail price, rather than negotiate for wholesale prices like the Army does. That's crazy. I mean, it was put in there just to kill Medicare.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, Mike, thanks for the call. Sorry to run up against the break there, but when they tell you that, they are lying to you or hallucinating.
The smartest thing I've ever heard anyone say about anything.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, by the way, at some point today, Shano, in his infinite wisdom and caprice, is going to yell, he's the guy, or she's the person, she's the woman, into my ear at when some caller is calling, and that person will get an autographed copy of what I think is one of the best books I've written in the last decade or so, Cracking the Code. The official subtitle is How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, but really it's a book about how America's original vision came about. That is the history of democracy, the history of the conservative and liberal movement, starting with Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Thomas Jefferson, and then how we communicate about that. It's also a book about neurolinguistic programming, techniques for communication, cracking the code. We will give that book away by me at some point today. So, Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening.
Hi, Tom. I first have to comment on the last caller, Mike from Virginia, whose attitude makes me so angry. His last comment was that he'd love for everybody to have health care, but we're $16 trillion in debt. Through no fault of the people who don't have health care, by the way. And his attitude is that since we're in debt, those people who don't have health care are not entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yep. And his first part, which he said, you can't give me something I already have, I was thinking, well, let's take your health care away, Mike. How about you go without it?
Yeah.
But here's the thing that's sad
and ironic about it, Paul. I would bet you just about any amount of money that Mike, the conservative who called earlier, echoing the kind of Rush Limbaugh lines, doesn't make the $400 million that Rush Limbaugh makes.
No, exactly.
That he doesn't have that kind of income. That he's not, you know, and yet he's echoing a message that and frankly, a national health care system and reduces the cost for health care for all of us, including the rich. And do we really want to live in a country of 50 million people who don't have access to health care because they don't have insurance? And only can get health care by showing up in an emergency room when they're actually melting down. And you know, even if we're well, even if you're wealthy and you have health insurance, do you really want to live in a country where the guy sitting next to you in the movie theater? Well, I suppose some rich people have their own movie theaters in their houses. But in any case, where the person sitting next to you on the plane, well, I guess the Romney rich have their own planes, don't they?
You see, you can't get there, Tom, because Mitt Romney has a medieval mentality that we should all live behind walls of Wall.
Well, does he really want to live in a world where his butler might, on the way to work, be sitting next to somebody who's coughing with tuberculosis, and his butler gets it, and then he gets it? I mean, you know, do you really want to be living in that country? And shouldn't we all be healthy?
All connected. We are all connected. But anyway, I wanted to call about your debate you had with the person about we're adopting the UN Charter.
Yeah, people, it wasn't so much a debate. I'm just curious about his worldview.
Okay. But the idea that you can find an idea, the notion that you can find an idea in the UN Charter or in the Bible. See, these are the kind of people who think that the nation was founded on Christian principles. Because, well, you can find something in the Bible that also exists in our law, such as you may not lie, steal, or
none of those things are in the Constitution.
Yeah, they're not in the Constitution, but if they exist in our laws, they think. See, well, I like to point out that, but 7 of the 10 commandments are not. It's legal to commit adultery. I'm sorry. You don't have to worship God in the way he's told, and you don't have to respect your parents. So there's so much that's not in there, but the fact there's anything coincidental, it might be interesting to find that things that Jesus taught also appear in the Communist Manifesto.
Yeah.
So the fact that we have points of human thought that come from various things doesn't mean they're not all separate. Not all writing is separate. So if you get something from the UN Charter that happens to be a good idea,
well, this isn't the UN Charter. This is Agenda 21, which came out of the Rio round. And actually was more recently kind of updated in the Rio de Janeiro round. But as Field Searcy correctly pointed out, it was originally signed off on by George Herbert Walker Bush. And basically it's about, you know, it's a good thing to have mixed use neighborhoods in towns so that people can walk to the store as well. You know,
sure.
So you don't have just residential areas that are like deserts, food deserts where there's no food. And everybody has to have a car. It's a good idea to have sustainable development so that, you know, we lower our carbon footprint. And
Tom, as a blind person, that's the kind of neighborhood I have to live in. I can't drive, and that's why I live where I do.
Right.
I'm from Michigan. I can't live there, Tom. You know what it's like there. You must have a car.
Oh yeah, pretty much anywhere. You're right.
I can't live in even my mother lives in Brighton, Michigan. You know that town.
I know the town.
I said, okay, it's just on the east of Lansing.
Yeah.
It's a little town, and I said, Mom, look, even as small as this town is, I couldn't live here because it's 2 miles to the store.
Yeah.
That's a 4-mile round trip for me. Even to where I live now, You know, it takes me 5 minutes to walk down to the corner.
Yeah.
But, you know, so the point thing, the other thing I wanted to point out is I haven't heard you mention this, and we talk a lot about foundations here, but actually the foundation of our republic came from Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws. That's the real Bible of this republic was the Spirit of the Laws. That's what the founders were talking about in terms of what kind of republic we should really be looking for. That was what the model that they were looking at.
And as well as the Iroquois Confederacy, the Roman Republic, the Greek democracy.
Sure.
They
were looking at what are the things that we have to come up with a unique solution, because our particular situation didn't really fit any of those.
Yeah.
We had to come up with something that was unique, and that's where the Constitution came from.
Yeah, and it was an amalgam of a variety of things, is an amalgam, and frankly, as Jefferson pointed out, it should be considered a living document. He said you wouldn't expect a man to wear the clothing that he wore as a child, and in fact, Jefferson wanted the Constitution revisited every 20 years, every generation, or actually every 19 years. He defined a generation as 19 years. Paul, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to Talk 1090 there in Seattle. We will be back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program in our second hour, why the end game for capitalism is near, and our geeky science alert, and your calls, and some other news.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We need a wall between corporation and state. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. But let me, you know, go back to the debate. One of the most fascinating things between Jefferson and Madison, one of the most fascinating things I learned when we moved into this house in Vermont in 1997, I think it was, and we bought this house that had been built in 1854, as I recall, and by Thomas Waterman Wood. And in the attic, over the garage, over what used to be the carriage house, there were several boxes of old books from the 1930s. There were magazines and things which kind of dated it all. And they were pretty badly damaged by the weather, which is why the previous owners had left them there. But included in those books was this 20-volume set of the collected writings of Thomas Jefferson. It had been published in 1909 by the Thomas Jefferson Society on the 100th anniversary of Thomas Jefferson leaving the White House, you know, the end of his presidency, the 100th anniversary of his presidency. And it had his diaries, it had his personal papers, I don't know if you call it an autobiography, but you know, his own, it was just everything was in there. It was amazing. A lot of it had never been published before. And Louise and I had just sold the ad agency in Atlanta, and we had sold it to our employees on a 7-year buyout. And we had a little time, we had a little money, and I was going to write some books. And so I just dug into this thing and started reading, and the thoughts, I mean, getting inside the head of Thomas Jefferson was just, for 2 years, this is what I did, is I was reading Jefferson, and I started writing a book that was going to be called What Would Jefferson Do? And then it went way, took a left turn and turned into Unequal Protection, the story of how Jefferson's vision of America got betrayed. Ultimately, later, I about a year after that, I wrote another book called What Would Jefferson Do?, which is still in print and is based on my reading of those books. But the reason I tell you this whole long story is that there was this correspondence between Jefferson and Madison that was absolutely fascinating, in which Jefferson was saying that if religious people, if priests was the word he used, were ever allowed to run for public office or ever successfully ran for public office, it wasn't a matter of allowing them. He just didn't, you know, at that point in time, nobody would have voted for one outside of Massachusetts, maybe. But if priests ever ran for public office, ministers, then they, by being having a primary loyalty to their church and a secondary loyalty to the Constitution, they would corrupt our constitutional republic. This was Jefferson's assertion to Madison. Madison had the opposite perspective. Now, Jefferson was skeptical of religious people. He was almost an atheist. He was a deist. Madison, on the other hand, was either a Presbyterian or a Congregationalist. I forget which it was, but one of those two. And he was sort of a Christian guy. And Madison was concerned that if the government ever started giving money to churches, it would corrupt religion. So here's Jefferson concerned that the churches are going to corrupt the government, and Madison concerned that the government's going to corrupt the churches. And, I mean, Madison actually, the proof of Madison's concern about this is his first veto. It was in, Madison became president in 1809, and I think it was in 1809, it might have been 1810, that Madison vetoed a bill that was passed that provided money. This was, you'll recall, I've mentioned many times, George Washington signed legislation to provide for a poorhouse in Washington, D.C., to provide medical care, health care, food for the poor in D.C. By 20 years later, 30 years later, during the Madison presidency, the preachers had gotten in, talked to the legislators, and said, you know, instead of the government running this poorhouse, why don't you give the money to us, the church leaders, and we will run the poorhouse. And so Congress appropriated money and gave it to the churches to run the poorhouse in D.C. And Madison vetoed it. It was his first veto. And you can Google this. It's fairly easy to read. And in that veto message, he went through this whole thing about how, you know, this would be a terrible precedent for our government to give anything to a church, because it will begin the corruption of Christianity. So the father of our Constitution, James Madison, he had this really interesting take on the separation between church and state. He wrote a letter to Baptist church leaders in 1811. He was president at the time, keep in mind. He said, I have always regarded the practical distinction between religion and civil government as essential to the purity of both. You got that? If you're going to have a wall between the two, it keeps them both pure. It protects them both. Madison knew that we shouldn't mix religion and government just to protect ourselves against the rise of theocrats, but also to preserve religion in its purest form, free from political meddling. Both entities, churches and state, are better off when they're separated entirely from each other. Now, I would submit that this same maxim holds true when it comes to corporations and state. When mixed, both become corrupted. Our founding fathers knew this all too well. They had rebelled not just against a monarchy, but also against the world's largest transnational corporation, the East India Company. Just before the American Revolution, virtually all of the members of the British Parliament were stockholders in the East India Company. A tenth had made their fortunes in the company, and the company generously funded parliamentary elections. Sound familiar? So Parliament was completely under the control of the East India Company, and thus in 1773, with the Tea Act of 1773, they were able to get the largest corporate tax cut in the history of the world at that point in time, which allowed the East India Company to undercut independent tea distributors here in the colonies. In November of 1773, the colonists responded to this by dressing up like Indians, boarding ships. They threw $1 million in today's dollars worth of tea into Boston Harbor, which triggered the American Revolutionary War, which might explain why our founding fathers, after independence, specifically chose not to give corporations any rights in our Constitution or even mention the word corporation at all in the entire document. It also explains why Thomas Jefferson was so wary of corporate power. He tried but failed to include freedom from monopolies in the Bill of Rights and wrote extensively about the dangers of an aristocracy rising up to take down our democratic government. But corporate power in America is relentless. Within 100 years of America's independence, morally bankrupt corporate slave masters in the South and morally bankrupt banksters and industrialists in the North tore our nation apart in a civil war. Lincoln was forced into an unholy alliance with those corporations in the North, giving them enormous subsidies to build railroads across the nation to help the war effort. And once the war was over, the railroads were controlled by just a few corporations that were largely owned by an even smaller number of families. The Vanderbilts, the Goulds, the other railroad elites, they rose up, and with their fortunes, they corrupted our government. The Ulysses Grant administration, one of the most corrupt of the entire robber baron era. Alarmed by all of this, in his 1888 State of the Union address, President Grover Cleveland, the only Democrat to serve as president during the Gilded Age, described what was going on in the United States. He said, quote, "As we view the achievements of aggregated capital, we discover the existence of trusts, combinations, and monopolies, while the citizen is struggling far in the rear or is trampled to death beneath an iron heel. Corporations, which should be the carefully restrained creatures of the law and the servants of the people, are fast becoming the people's masters." End of quote. This was from the State of the Union address by the President of the United States in 1888, identifying the last Gilded Age. Now we're in another Gilded Age. It's back. And my point in all this is to say that, yes, corporations can pollute and distort government, and are all the time. But the flip side of that is that government can pollute and distort corporations by giving them goodies.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We need a wall of separation, not just between church and state, but between corporation and state. We need to go back to Teddy Roosevelt's Tillman Act of 1908.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
Okay, Thursday, let's get geeky. One of the biggest problems facing ocean ecosystems today is the dwindling number of healthy coral reefs, which provide homes for hundreds of species of underwater creatures. Besides the typical reasons for coral reef decline, you know, pollution, stuff like that, another danger coral reefs are facing is coming into contact with invasive and deadly species of seaweed. Left unchecked, seaweed and seaweed algae can overrun a coral reef. But now it appears that when killer seaweed touches one particular species of coral, Acropora nasuta, that coral releases chemical compounds that signal certain varieties of fish to come to the coral's aid and eat the seaweed. In coral reefs, the coral and the invading seaweed compete for both light and space, and as coral reefs decline from pollution, climate change, other factors, the seaweed begins to take over the area. It even kills baby coral or larval coral. But with Acropora nasuta coral, when it's invaded by toxic and deadly seaweed, it's able to stop the spread of the seaweed by getting help from the fish nearby. This discovery was made by researchers at the Georgia Institute of Technology. They first caged individual Acropora nasuta corals, and then for each of the corals, the researchers either left alone or removed some of the creatures that rely on the coral for a home. Next, they tested the reactions the coral had to Chlorodesmus fastigiata, one of the species of seaweeds that is most dangerous and toxic to corals. Initially, when the researchers attached the toxic seaweed to dangle near the coral, first group of fish, they're called damselfishes, just ignored the chemical calls of help from the corals and ignored the seaweed. But two species of small goby fish that rely on the coral for shelter and a home became like little hedge trimmers, according to the researchers, trimmed down the seaweed. Both types of goby fish chewed away at the seaweed until it wasn't brushing against the coral anymore. The researchers found that the trigger that caused the goby fish to eat the seaweed came from a chemical excreted by the coral itself. They also found that eating the toxic seaweed was good for the goby fish. Some species of goby fish have fairly toxic skin, and when they're eaten by predators, the toxins released in the skin cause the predator to have a difficult time swimming. So after coming in contact with the predator, goby fish that had chewed away the toxic seaweed caused their predators to have trouble swimming even faster. So here we have this called symbiosis, this mutually beneficial relationship between the coral and the goby fish. But besides discovering a new symbiotic relationship, and then what's the bottom line to this research? Well, the fact is there's an incredible amount of communication going on between organisms in our environment, in this case the coral and the goby fish, a communication that's essential for survival. It exists outside of the water. Acacia trees produce a chemical known as tannin to defend themselves from grazing animal. The scent of that tannin is picked up by neighboring acacia trees, which in turn produce more tannin to protect themselves and the same animals. And when attacked by caterpillars, several varieties of plants release a chemical that attracts parasitic wasps that eat the caterpillars. If we want nature and the environment around us to thrive and survive, we not only have to work to really, you know, reduce pollution, curb climate change, all that kind of stuff, but we have to understand it's the web of life. It's these crucial lines of communication between organisms. It's the web of life. It's an amazing, amazing thing. So, anyhow, Dorothy in Liberty, Maine. Hey, Dorothy, you are in the state where the chairman of your Republican Party. In fact, here, let me just, because if you want to comment on his clip, on his comment, play his clip for you here in just a second when I cue it up. You there, Dorothy?
Yes, I am.
Okay,
hello.
Hang on. Yeah, here's what he had to say. The head of the Republican Party in Maine.
In some parts of rural Maine, there were dozens of black people who came in to vote on Election Day. Everybody has a right to vote. But nobody in town knows anybody that's black. How did it happen? I don't know. We're going to find out. I think it's a problem. I think it's a problem.
Where did that happen?
And then the guy says, where did that happen? He says, many communities in Maine. So you had some comments on this since you live in Liberty, Maine.
Well, I think he's the biggest wing nut that we probably have in the state, if that's any consolation.
Okay.
Most people don't think there's anything left in Maine other than beyond Kennebunkport. And I'm from a little town, and I can't imagine bussing people in to vote. We have our voter registration, and we have our laws.
Right.
Where did he get this idea?
Well, I think he's making it up, or I think it falls into the category of what are called apocryphal stories, the Vanishing Hitchhiker kind of story. Charlie Webster, the head of the Republican Party in Maine, says when the interviewer asked him, where did this happen, that these black people showed up to vote in small towns and nobody in the small town knew any black people, he says, well, it happened in several rural communities. Can you name one? No, it didn't happen.
I believe it. Mm-hmm. I don't think he could.
Yeah.
I think he's a sore loser.
Yeah.
I think our former Governor Angus King will do a wonderful job.
Yeah. Did you expect that Angus King would caucus with the Democrats?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I thought he would.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think that most Mainers who voted for him did so because they thought he would end up caucusing with the Democrats? Because he ran as an independent.
He did run as an independent, but I think he got the vote because people are tired of the foolishness that's going on in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And I think they remember him as our governor and what he did for our state. Mm-hmm. And I think he did an excellent job.
Did Angus King not used to be a Republican?
He used to be, and he went independent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was elected governor of the state of Maine as an independent.
Yep.
And then he took some time off after his governorship, and now he's
caucusing with the governor, with the Democrats. Yeah, very interesting. Dorothy, thanks for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Liberty, Maine. We will be right back 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Smart growth, clustered development, bike paths, conservation, mixed-use zoning, it's all a plot by the United Nations to steal our liberties.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So here's the question. We've got all these paranoid right-wingers. What can we do to convince them they need to be more concerned about the World Trade Organization than the UN? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Robert in Ramona, California. Robert, you have a comment on Mitt Romney's gift statement?
Yes, well, it's a right. You know, Mitt wants, you know, these abusive predators, they never want the rest of us to have what they were given. He didn't pay for his college.
No.
he didn't even pay for, apparently his father gave him his first million or two to invest.
Yes, it was $1 million that his father gave him in stock, and then he and Ann lived off that while they were in college.
Hard times.
Yeah, yeah, it's really tough. Yeah, it's really tough. So, excellent point, Robert. And in fact, you know, there's an analysis, and thank you for the call. There's an analysis over on Newsweek's site, on Daily Beast, where they took the states that get the most federal dollars and the states that get the least federal dollars per capita. It's all around $16,000 per person, you know, that comes back. And some states spend more than that into the federal government. Some states send less than that into the federal government. But they took the states that got the most and the least, put them on a scatter graph, you know, plotted them on a graph, and then plotted on one axis how much it was, on the vertical axis, on the horizontal axis, whether they voted for Obama or for Romney. No correlation. Makes no difference. Now, I would say that, you know, this was not an election about gifts. But in the Republican world, this is really a big deal. And to understand how it's a big deal, you have to go back to the 1970s. In the 1970s, the Republican Party was in absolute despair. By 73, the Republican Party, I mean, keep in mind what had happened. In 64, Goldwater just got crushed by Lyndon Johnson. I mean, crushed. And then in 73, Richard Nixon had to resign in disgrace because of Watergate. There were, you know, my dad was alive back then, and he was a Republican back then, and I remember having these conversations with him, and he was like, this is it. Party's over. I mean, there were Republicans who really thought the party was just never going to rise out of the ashes. But the good and noble party of Dwight Eisenhower. What are we going to do? Nixon has totally destroyed any credibility that we had. And Goldwater, I mean, you know, conservatism has been repudiated by the American people. And so this guy by the name of Jude Winiski came along. And Jude had this suggestion, and he wrote about it in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal in the mid-70s. And Jude said, correctly, that the American people viewed the Democratic Party and the Democrats as Santa Claus. He said, look at all these gifts that the Democrats have been responsible for giving us. If it hadn't been for the Democratic Party, Americans would be working a 50- or 60-hour work week instead of a 40-hour work week. They wouldn't be represented by unions. There would be no Medicare. There would be no Medicaid. This was actually, this was post-Medicare. There'd be no Medicare. There'd be no Medicaid. There'd be no Social Security. There'd be no unemployment benefits. There'd be no health and safety regulations for food and drugs, although some of that came under the Republican Teddy Roosevelt, but he was a progressive. He was an anomaly in the Republican Party. But basically, you know, what Winiski said was all this good stuff that government does has been done by Democrats. And Republicans have always just said no. No, we can't do that. No, we don't want that. No, we don't, you know, don't raise our taxes to pay for that. And he accurately said in the mid-70s that the Republican Party has become the party of Scrooge and the Democratic Party is the party of Santa Claus. So he said the Republican Party, if they want to start winning elections and continue to win elections, has to do two things. And if you want the details and the actual verbatim quotes on this, just Google Jude Winiski, Two Santa Claus Theory, Tom Hartman, and you'll find a bunch of articles that I've written about this over the years. With the actual quotes and links to the original article and all kinds of stuff. But anyhow, he said the Republican Party has to do two things. The first is they have to stop being the party of Scrooge and start becoming the party of Santa Claus. They have to be their own Santa Claus. Now, the giving people decent working conditions and decent wages and minimum wage and all that stuff, that's already been taken by the Democratic Party. So if we Republicans are going to become Santa Claus, we can't do that stuff because we'll just look like we've become Democrats. So we've got to figure out another way to be Santa Claus. So let's become Santa Clauses with tax cuts. Let's become the party of tax cuts. Now, before the mid-70s, the Republican Party was not the party of tax cuts. Republican President Dwight Eisenhower was quite happy to have top tax rates at 91%. Corporations paid 35% of the total cost of running government during the Eisenhower administration. It's down to around 9% now. They were not the party of tax cuts. When Richard Nixon was president, they were not the party of tax cuts. He was not running a tax cut platform. When Richard Nixon was president, the top tax rate was 74%. It had been lowered by Lyndon Johnson, who also closed up a bunch of loopholes, which increased the revenue. But there was actually, it was actually a tax increase. I've played that Jack Kennedy clip for you from the Kennedy-Nixon debates before. I'm not going to do it again, but this is an old story. So it was 74%. The Republican Party was never the party of tax cuts. And Jude Winiski said, we've got to, number one, become the party of Santa Claus, tax cuts, because everybody hates taxes. So we're in favor of tax cuts. Even though, you know, half of Americans don't even pay federal income taxes, they don't realize that. And so we'll become the party of tax cuts and everybody will love us. But number two, and more important, we have to figure out a way to force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus. Yes, that was the phrase Jude Winiski used. Shoot Santa Claus. We have to figure out a way to force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus. Now, how do you do that? How do you get the Democrats to take a bite out of, to put a bullet through the Social Security that they created? How do you force Democrats to go back on the minimum wage? How do you force Democrats to roll back Medicare? How do you force Democrats to shoot Santa Claus? Well, Jude Winiski said, it's a very simple program. Since the Republicans should become the party of Santa Claus by offering tax cuts, they should offer those tax cuts in ways that radically drive up the national debt. Keep in mind, when Ronald Reagan came into office, outside of fighting World War I, World War II, and the Civil War, our debt as a percentage of GDP was pretty much the same place it had been during the George Washington administration. In fact, it was lower than during the George Washington administration because we owed all this money to the French for the Revolutionary War. We had never had a serious debt problem in the United States. And when we fought those wars, we recovered very quickly. We bounced back with a lot of economic activity and paid it off by simply, you know, employing more people. We never had employed austerity. So what Winiski said was, as the new party of Santa Claus, the Republican Party, when it comes into office and into power, should cut taxes so radically that it drives the national debt through the ceiling. Now, immediately, all the Republicans, all the conservatives started going, what are you talking about? And he's like, no, just keep listening. Because once you've run up that debt, American politics goes in cycles. Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican. Democrats will come back into power. And when they do, the single job of the Republican Party when Democrats are in power is to force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus. To force the Democrats to cut Social Security benefits. To force the Democrats to cut Medicare benefits. To force to prevent the Democrats from increasing unemployment benefits. To force the Democrats to even cut back on unemployment benefits. In fact, the Republicans did this last year. They got Obama to take long-term unemployment from 99 weeks down to 74 weeks. Force the Democrats to shoot Santa. How? By screaming about the debt that the Republicans created. So when Republicans are in power, run up huge debts, don't say a word about it. Nobody, no conservative is allowed to complain about it. Because soon a Democrat will come into office and then we can scream about the debt. We can put national debt clocks everywhere. We can have GOP TV, Fox News, talk about the debt. We can get commentators on. We can write op-ed pieces. Our legislators can run for Congress. We got to stop. We got to do something about the national debt. And then we can force the Democrats in the name of debt control, a debt run up by Republicans. Again, keep in mind, before the Reagan presidency, we never had a debt problem in this country. Ronald Reagan tripled the national debt, took it from $1 trillion to $3 trillion. George Herbert Walker Bush added another $1.5 trillion to it. Bill Clinton offered a balanced budget, in fact, created a surplus. But then George W. Bush came in and he said, that surplus from Bill Clinton is so big, we're going to pay off the national debt. That's what he said in his first national address, his first State of the Union address. And then he said, oops. Somebody came to him and said, are you out of your mind? Read this paper by Judah Wininsky. Get with the program. And so George W. Bush got with the program and added $5 trillion to the national debt instead of paying it off. And put in place structural systems like, you know, saying Medicare can't negotiate prescription drugs, so it's going to have to run in the red. The post office has to fund employee benefits, health and retirement benefits 75 years in advance. It's got to run in the red. Put in place systems that would guarantee that when a Democrat came into office, the Republicans could all scream about the debt and force the Democrat to shoot Sam. That's what this is all about.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Mitt Romney knows it. Rush Limbaugh knows it. All these guys know it, and they are playing this game on you. They are playing it good. Okay, in an earlier segment, by the way, I was ranting about the need for a separation between corporation and state. Franklin Roosevelt talked about something very similar to that back when he was president of the United States. And I just want to play a very, very short clip of FDR on that topic. Here he is.
We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism, sectionalism, war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
Government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. So well said. Alex in Santa Cruz. Hey, Alex, you wanted to comment on Romney's gift metaphor?
Yeah, during my youth, I used to, well, I'm still pretty young, but when I, about 20 years ago, I used to travel a lot throughout the world. And one of the places I went to was Havana in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there being a big difference, a generational difference between those youths under 30 that were born well after the Bautista regime was conquered by Castro, mm-hmm. and those that were alive during the Castro regime. And there was a definite pattern. If you were under 30, you were pretty much against Castro, and you thought that all the street pavements in Miami were covered in gold, and all you had to do was get on a boat and go to Miami, and you just work at McDonald's for 6 months and be a rich millionaire.
Right.
And those youths, the lesson of that story was the people before the Batista conquering, they were not necessarily pro-Castro, but they weren't pro-Clinton in those days.
They understood that when Cuba was kind of an appendage to the United States and was basically run by the mafia, that life was not that good for most Cubans.
Right. And my point is that there's generational differences, and there's people take for granted what they have. Mm. These same youth were totally literate, had university degrees, were taxi drivers with engineering degrees, et cetera, had free medical care. There was basically no crime in Havana at the time. Now, they take for granted, and it's out of the collective memory, the cause and effect. And I would argue that that's what's going on right now with the Jude Lewinsky theory that you're positing, because all these white Republicans who are saying, take your government hands off my Medicare and Social Security, they've lost that out of their collective memory that it was the Democratic Party that gave them those gifts.
Yes.
And that, coupled with the fact that you have a media that's totally brainwashing people, you got people that are, you know, Generation Xers like myself, that's out of our collective memory. We take for granted all of the things that FDR, the Democrats, did for us, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid.
Minimum wage, yeah, workplace safety laws, yeah.
And that's why you got these people like Romney and these people in who I work with, working class people, white people, who are saying things outlandish about, you know, Obama got elected because he was giving away, you know, candy to mm-hmm. the people. And they themselves are benefiting from the candy that Democrats have, you know, been supporting for the last 60 to 70 years.
Yeah, agreed. Excellent point, Alex. Thank you very much. Steve, in Perrysville, Indiana, you had some thoughts on mind control?
Obama, he's controlling my mind because, you know, I wanted the freedom to, you know, for the rich to have to pay taxes like I do. And for...
Wait a minute. You want Mitt Romney to pay more than 14% on federal income taxes on his tens of millions of dollars of income every year?
Believe it. I think he should be paying about 90%.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree. When the top tax rate was 91% in the United States, we had the strongest economy we've ever had. And we had the strongest middle class. It's a simple fact.
And another thing, I'm one of these people that's getting that free stuff that I had to pay for, you know, Social Security and Medicare and supplemental to Medicare.
Right.
I make payments every month, but, you know, to him it's free.
Yep. Yep. Well, the payments that you're making, I'm guessing, are less than Romney tips his butler every day, you know, so in his mind, it probably is free. Steve, thank you for the call. Well said. George in Albert Lea, Minnesota, you're asking if I understand why there's a limit on FICA taxes?
Yeah.
The theory behind cutting FICA taxes off at $110,000 is that there's a limit on how much you get back in Social Security. And so,
your benefits are capped, which is why there's a limit. So I'm trying to figure out why you don't mention that when you engage in your class warfare about, well, Mitt Romney should be paying more.
Well, I think he should be.
It seems to me you're just want to turn Social Security then into a welfare program.
Well, what you're misunderstanding, respectfully, George, is the purpose of Social Security. I'm guessing that you think it's an old age investment program, a retirement program.
No.
It's not. It never was intended as that.
It was designed by Roosevelt to get people out of the workforce and get them some kind of retirement to lower the unemployment high unemployment rate of the 30s that his big government policies were causing.
His big government policies are causing. You mean the start in 1929, 3 years before Roosevelt came into office, after three consecutive Republican administrations?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Coolidge wasn't responsible for it. Herbert Hoover instituted big government programs. Roosevelt ran against those, ran against the big government spending, and when he turned around and got into office, he doubled down on Hoover's reckless... we would characterize it as liberal government programs today.
George, you're engaging in some radical revisionist history. But let me just, for the purposes of our listeners, clarify. Social Security is an old age and young age poverty and disaster insurance program. In fact, go back and look at the original program. The word insurance is part of it. The I in FICA is insurance. It is an insurance program. And that's why I think that you should pay no matter what you make.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, perhaps one of the most, welcome back to the program, by the way, one of the most amazing things that happened in this last election is that four, if my recollection is correct, LGBT members of Congress are now in office. And I think the number before was Barney Frank, wasn't it? Pretty much. And this is a big deal. And there were four states where LGBT issues were on the ballot, three to legalize gay marriage and one to ban it by constitutional amendment. And in every case, people said, OK, we're for gay marriage. This seems to be the civil rights issue of our era. The American perspectives are changing. We're kind of post miscegenation, you know, but there are those folks who are saying, nah, not ready to change yet. Dr. Michael Brown is with us. He's the host of the Line of Fire radio program, nationally syndicated, the author of 22 books, including his latest, A Queer Thing Happened to America. His website is askdrbrown.com. askdrbrown.org, as in askdrbrown.org. And Dr. Michael Brown, welcome to our program.
Great to be back with you again, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thank you. The Family Research Council is calling for civil disobedience to block same-sex marriages. How does that work?
Well, I'm not a spokesman for FRC, but what I understand them to mean is that if a Christian in good conscience could not participate in something having to do with recognizing same-sex marriage, they would do it. I mean, we've got a long, rich tradition of civil disobedience on all sides in America.
So this would be like, you know, just as an example, when I was a teenager, I lived in a white neighborhood, and the girl next door to us, she was a few years older than me, she wanted to marry a black man. Now, this was in the 60s. Her father was so offended by that, he refused to walk her down the aisle. She asked my father to. He did. Our families never again talked. It was the schism, you know, between the two families. But that was an act of civil disobedience on the part of her father. She ended up marrying a black man, and never again, to the best of my knowledge, a decade or so that I kept in touch with them, interacted with her family. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Well, no, you know, it's interesting. My first organ teacher when I was 5 years old was an openly gay man, and he and his partner would come and have dinner at our home. This is early 60s. Then my next organ teacher was a black man married to a white woman that was also ostracized, that was often in our home as a couple. So my thinking is very different on that. I do not insult the civil rights movement by equating sexual desires, romantic attraction with skin color, nor do I equate the...
Why not? You're born with both.
No, there's no scientific evidence to say you're born with both.
Okay, well, let me ask you a really simple question.
There's literature there.
It seems interesting to me that there are some people who spend all their time, apparently straight people, who spend all of their time thinking about gay people and what they're doing. And, you know, I asked Dr. Paul Cameron of the Family Research Institute this question, and you know, do you have... Or do you think that you have interests in men, sexual interests in men from time to time? And Dr. Cameron basically said, well, you know, doesn't everybody? And I said, no, I don't.
I guess by that you would be a closet conservative then, because
I'm
bashing conservatives, so you must be a secret conservative.
I mean, I've been there and done that, you know, but the thing that fascinates me is that most people, I get it that there are a few exceptions, you know, the kind of the Larry Craigs of the world, but most people can tell you how old they were when they realized their sexuality. I mean, I was probably 7 years old thereabouts when I noticed that I thought girls were quite different than boys, and there was something really fascinating about them. And I'm guessing the same is true of you.
Yeah, my interest in girls, I mean, as soon as you get past the thing of ooh, girls, when you're like in first grade or something, yeah, I've been heterosexual, and if I've...
Okay, so what do you say to somebody who says, when I first became aware of sexuality, you know, which is long before adolescence, I mean, people, you know, I was attracted to people of the same sex, not to people of the opposite sex. How do you tell them?
I believe every word they're saying, and I have...
Okay, then how can you say they aren't born that way?
Because things are developed in early years of our childhood, many, many deep things in our behavior and our lifestyle. Plus, there's no scientific evidence that can point definitively to a gay gene or whatever. And look, people are arguing...
There is no scientific evidence for your behavioral theory.
That we both absolutely deplore. And people claim there's a gene for that, a violent gene, a pedophile gene. So to me, it almost... I want to treat this person as a fellow human being with dignity and respect, but to say I'm not going to...
Then why not let them get married?
I'm not going to redefine marriage based on your sexual desires or romantic attraction.
Why?
Because marriage has been in society for a certain purpose, which is to join a child with a mother and father and to have the possibility of procreation. And to say that marriage should just be...
I've had a vasectomy. I can't procreate. So are you suggesting... That I, you know, if my wife, God forbid, should divorce me, that I should not be allowed to marry?
No, because the rule is...
Then you're saying marriage isn't just for procreation.
I didn't say it was just for. I said it's for the possibility of procreation and the joining of a kid with a mother and father. But, I mean, that's a whole other subject. I know you wanted to talk on the civil disobedience end. And the fact is, no one's trying to stop people from living how they want to live. If my next door neighbors were a gay couple and they went away, I'd mow their lawn or help them out or have them over for dinner. But I'm not going
to. But you want to stop them from being able to visit each other in the hospital when they're sick or being able to inherit from each other. I don't understand that.
I'm all for them being able to visit each other in the hospital just like a heterosexual couple who's living together outside of wedlock.
Well, there's tens of thousands of laws in the United States that refer to the word marriage. Why not? You know, I respect your right in your church to say we're not going to marry gays here. I think it's wrong, and I think eventually we'll come to view that with the same horror that we view churches that, like the Mormon Church, up until the late 70s or early 80s, said, you know, they would not recognize interracial couples. But for the moment, you know, I'll say your church can be, you know, bigoted if you want, but why should the secular state be bigoted?
Well, the secular state only has an interest in marriage because marriage conveys benefits on the secular state, which same-sex couples do not convey.
Of course they do.
Tom, do you have an issue with polygamous marriages? Because that's in the courts now, too.
This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about marriage equality.
You have a moral objection to polygamous marriages because they have a longer history than same-sex marriage. It's around the world, and it's in the courts in America today, and they're using the same arguments. There are gay folks I've talked to. They're against polygamy. So the question is, where does one draw the line?
I think you draw the line at monogamy. Michael, you asked me a question. Let me give you the answer. There was once a reason for polygamy. And that reason was that 3,000, 4,000 years ago, when it was a bunch of tribes running around in the desert, killing each other in incredible numbers, the number of men to the number of women, the ratio was not 50-50. It might have been one man for every two women or one man for every three women because the men were killing each other off. In that kind of a world, polygamy makes sense. That's not the world we live in anymore. Polygamy doesn't make sense anymore.
So marriage is going to be redefined based on the world we live in. And if the world we live in proves in a generation that it's best for a kid to have a mom and dad and that same-sex marriage opened the door to polygamous marriage and incestuous marriage, which is all before
now,
then maybe your views will change. Maybe you sound bigoted. And what you say to polygamists, to the 1 million-plus Muslims, you sound bigoted. To people in 140 nations, you sound bigoted.
It may well be. It may well be, but I stand by that. I don't think that – but this is not a discussion about polygamy. It's a discussion about gay marriage and why anybody would say that somebody should not have the rights – that, you know, simple taxation rights. I
didn't get married for taxation rights. You could take them all away. I'm going to be committed to my wife in marriage. It doesn't matter.
Okay. Dr. Michael Brown, host of the Line of Fire radio program, author of 22 books, his latest, The Queer Thing Happened to America. AskDrBrown.org is the website. Dr. Brown, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
So how long is it going to be in America before this one passes? And we say, yeah, of course, these are part of all of us.
Love and marriage, love and marriage. They go together like a horse and carriage.
There you go. I mean, you know, whether you're straight or gay, love and marriage should go together. It's really pretty simple. Patrick in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Patrick, you wanted to talk about history?
Yes, sir, Tom. Thanks for taking my phone call. I'm a long-time listener, but this is the first time I've actually gotten to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
I'm an American history teacher here in Nashville.
Good on you.
And thank you. This is year 20 for me. So I have been infuriated by the number of callers that have called in to speak to you and all of these other people who are wanting to rewrite American history, and I think because they probably sat and daydreamed in a history class at some time or another in their life, they think they know what this country is about, what it was founded on, what it was intended to be for the world.
Or they've watched Glenn Beck with his revisionist historian, what's the guy's name? I want to say David Brooks, and that's not it. It's David something or other. But anyway, he's got this, yeah, this guy who just makes up these quotes for the founders that they were all Christians. David Barton, is that his name? You know who I'm talking about?
I think so. Yeah. They weren't Christians. They were deists.
Right.
You know, the majority of them. Jefferson and
the majority of them were Thomas Paine, especially.
Oh, Paine was an atheist. You know, he wrote The Age of Reason. In fact, he was ostracized when he came back after the French Revolution because of The Age of Reason. When he died, only seven people showed up for his funeral.
Exactly. I mean, he was soundly rejected by his peers later on.
Yeah.
And this, he was the guy who, you know, we might not have ever had the American Revolution without Thomas Paine.
That's right. Without the crisis. Yes.
And common sense.
Yes.
Yeah, the crisis he wrote during the course of the revolution. These folks that say America has had two constitutions, the Articles of Confederation and our current constitution we have today.
Correct.
And you had a gentleman that called in the other day who was talking about how America would be better off if we had these individual strengthened states that were more sovereign, I believe was the word that he used. Well, you know what? We had that.
Yes.
It was the Articles of Confederation, and it was a disaster.
Yes, it didn't work out very well at all.
The executive branch. There was no federal judiciary to handle court cases. Interstate commerce, oh my goodness, forget about it. Everybody was printing their own money. It was a disaster. And our founding fathers knew that the individual states in and of themselves as entities were incapable of getting along and cooperating with one another, especially after Shays' Rebellion.
Yep.
And so they, in 1787, they get together in Philadelphia, and what was initially a plan to revise the Articles became throw them out completely, and let's just come up with a whole brand new way of doing this. And they wrote into that constitution that we have today mechanisms for joining the Union, but they did not write in any mechanisms for getting out of the Union.
As Abraham Lincoln so eloquently pointed out, yes.
Exactly. We are the United States of America. United. That's it. You don't get out. It's just like the mafia. Once you get in, you don't get out again. That's just part of the deal.
Yeah, I would hope to find a better metaphor, or an analogy, but yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's just what it is. Mm. They never intended for a state to ever leave. Why would one ever want to? And also this, in Article 7 of our Constitution, which deals with the ratification process, it only took 9 states to ratify the Constitution for it to go into effect.
Yep.
Those of the 13 states that we had, I believe, wasn't it New York and Virginia were the two holdouts?
I don't recall. I thought Georgia was one of them, but I could be wrong.
It might have been Georgia and possibly New York. But here's the deal. When the 9th state, which I believe was New Hampshire, ratified, it went into effect. Even though those other states didn't vote for it, too bad. You're now in,
right.
You don't have any say so in it. It now becomes the law of the land because the majority of the 13 states have now voted for it.
It was a supermajority. It was the 3/4. Yeah.
Yeah.
The same thing
for a
constitutional amendment or a constitutional convention. Yeah.
Right. And we're going to pull you in and you're going to be part of it whether you want to or not.
Yep.
And so there is no mechanism for getting out.
Yeah.
And it drives me insane that these people think they know what our founders.
Well, here's the problem, Patrick. There's an entire industry, the conservative entertainment complex, an entire industry feeding these people misinformation.
Exactly.
I mean, it's really tragic. But go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we've got this phrase here in the South.
I'm sorry, Patrick. I gotta drop you. We gotta dump that. And my apologies to anybody who heard a nasty word there, but Shane thinks he caught it. Craig in Calabasas, California. Hey, Craig, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you? I'm a longtime listener, but I'm not a follower of your end. I'm just right of center fiscal conservative, and I wanted to talk about the election in California, Prop 30, and the fiscal cliff. I am married with 2 kids, in the upper 1% income earners, but I do not own my own business. My wife and I both work. We've done everything by the book. We've been married 19 years, And with Prop 30 in California passing, not only is my family going to face an $11,000 tax increase, we're getting it retroactively put to us for 2012, which I have a real problem with.
Yeah.
On top of that, when you talk about the fiscal cliff and the upper 1 or 2% not paying their fair share, I'm someone, while I don't want taxes to go up, if they do go up, I think that they should go up a percentage on everybody.
Well, if you're in the top 1%, Craig, you're making more than $325,000 a year. I'm not crying for you if you're having to pay an extra $12,000 in taxes.
I'm actually middle class. Can we take it after the break?
No, I can't. Once we start doing that, it's a disaster.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Would you be sobbing for somebody making $325,000 who's having to pay an extra $12,000 a year in taxes? Yeah. The good, the bad, and the very, very outrageously ugly, the good. Legislators in Rhode Island and Maine. State legislators in both states will be introducing bills to legalize marijuana in their respective states, according to the Marijuana Policy Project. And the MPP also says that two other states, Massachusetts and Vermont, will be introducing marijuana legalizing legislation in the near future. It seems that last week's landmark decisions in Washington State and Colorado have spurred momentum to legalize marijuana across the country. Now it's time for the federal government to end Nixon's failed war on drugs and create sensible drug policies. The bad. Senator John McCain. McCain has been relentless in attacking President Obama over his role in the Benghazi consulate attacks. McCain has repeatedly called for a select committee to investigate Benghazi and for the government to release more information on the attacks. Well, yesterday, McCain skipped a closed-door briefing where administration officials were giving that more information on Benghazi. He skipped that so he could attend a press conference with fellow witch-hunting Republicans to criticize that there wasn't information about Benghazi. I guess Senator McCain really doesn't want the answer that badly after all. And the very, very ugly Maine Republican Party Chairman Charlie Webster. In an interview on a local NBC affiliate, Webster said he was astounded by the dozens of black people who voted in the election and said he thought it was odd because he didn't know any black people himself. He then went on to suggest that because he or any of his friends didn't personally know any black people in the area, they must have been committing voter fraud. Mr. Webster's comments really speak for themselves and are very, very ugly. It's incredible. Okay, Zach in Scottsdale, Arizona says here you disagree with me, so you go to the front of the line. What's up, Zach?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Move back a little bit and say that I do believe you're probably the best news source in the nation for talking about money and politics. However, I really am I'm pretty frustrated these days because I see a lot of confusion with this whole corporations or people versus the money is speech. These are the two doctrines from move to amend.
Right.
And what I see happening is a lot of the fingers being pointed at the corporations as really the source of the problem of money in politics, when only 150 people provided 80% of the super PAC funds.
Right.
So I think when we're trying to create a movement and, you know, trying to tell people what the problem is, well, clearly there's a lot of, you know, problem with the corporations. It's really the corporations, they've gotten their power through being able to control government through this money speech, which was, you know, put in place in the 1976 Buckley versus Filio decision. And that, I really think, is the original sin, which I think you're really putting Reagan's tax breaks for the rich. You're putting the cart before the horse, because I know you always point to Reagan's tax breaks as the original sin.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you. I think the Buckley case, if you want to take an original sin even before that, look to 1973 when Justice Lewis Powell was put on the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon 3 months after he wrote the Powell memo to his best friend and next-door neighbor, the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, whose name has long escaped into the dim recesses of memory. But The Powell memo laid out the process by which, you know, this was at the same time that Jude Wininsky was coming up with the two Santa Claus theory for the Republican Party. Powell was looking at the conservative movement, and he was saying we need to take over the schools, everything from the elementary schools to the colleges. We need to take over the court system. We need to create the Federalist Society and start, you know, educating and stacking our judges in there. We need to take over the military. We need to take over the media. We need to be playing the refs, as it were. We need to organize corporate America and turn it into a political force. The Chamber of Commerce has always been apolitical. They've always felt that the best part of patriotism is to simply get their job done. Eugene Snyder, Shano tells me, was the chamber president, the CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce at the time that Lewis Powell wrote the memo to him. And yes, that name sounds familiar. Thank you, Shano. And it was Powell who, you know, in my opinion, I don't have proof for this other than, you know, his writing in the opinion, but was pushing the Buckley Doctrine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Three years later.
And what I do believe is Powell also sat on the board of the tobacco companies, Philip Morris.
Yes.
And they had a strong influence over the ACLU because they provided the ACLU with a lot of funding.
Yeah.
So I do believe there was some, you know, corruption as far as that relationship and getting the ACLU to adopt the money is not speech, or money is speech. They do believe they supported Citizens United. So I think it's really funny. The ACLU on one hand is trying to, you know, protect civil liberties and go after terrorism. And the other hand, they're basically enabling the military industrial complex to, really have total control over our government.
Right.
So, and kind of going back to the Jude Wininsky thing, I think there were two ways to take down Santa Claus. One was to shoot Santa Claus. The other way was to essentially transform Santa Claus into Scrooge, which happens when the Democrats depend on the 1% money just like the Republicans.
Yep.
And that's why our health care bill was a giveaway to the insurance corporations.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And although I think that, again, we could take that back to that original sin of the Buckley case. I'm totally with you. Zach, Shane tells me that you're the guy he wants to give a copy of my book, Cracking the Code, to. So I'm going to put you on hold. Say what? But. You know. So I'm going to put you on hold. Zach is on line 8. You can tell Danielle. And so that she can get your address information, I'll autograph a copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, my book about America's original vision, and we're going to send it to you. Michael, in Dublin, Virginia, you wanted to talk about Obama needs to represent corporate interests to maintain our lifestyle? I don't get it.
Okay, well, if you look at, you know, are you familiar with the U.S. Code? I know you are, the United States Code, Title 28-3002. 15, A, B, and C. Now, it says some things in there.
Actually, I'm not. Tell me what part of the U.S. Code are you citing?
I'm referring to, okay, and I looked this up. It's Title 28,
right.
3002,
okay.
15.
What is it, so what is it about?
It says that the United States is a corporation, in words. It says that, exactly that. It says the United States is a corporation.
The federal corporation.
Now, well, in what? Federal court?
A federal corporation. The word federal
right.
is in that.
Yes. So what we have is President Obama. I looked at his face when you were talking about the fiscal cliff and global warming. No, you're talking about global warming. He has to represent the coal industry, the fossil fuel, all these corporations.
No, he doesn't.
Excuse me?
No, he doesn't. He has to deal with the political reality that these companies have trillions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars at the very least, that they could use to destroy him politically if they chose to, but he doesn't represent them. He represents the people who voted for him. You know, this is back to the discussion we just had with Zach a minute ago about the consequences of money in politics.
I used the wrong word. He has to deal with them, but he also
sure.
has to deal with the American public. But he has to, again, they have tremendous power and money to not only to destroy him politically, but to destroy the lifestyle of the American people. And so
which they've been doing aggressively for 32 years.
They have been. They have been doing it, and the people themselves have to hold their representatives, the president, accountable for what they do.
Yeah, but not just the president. Let's keep in mind, all legislation that has to do with taxation or spending has to originate in the House of Representatives. So if you want to look at where you know, legislatively, you know, the legally, the changing of laws, the changing of tax policy, the changing of spending policy, where this all originates, it all goes back to the House of Representatives. The president can do nothing more than speak loudly when it comes to those thing, kind of things. He can sign a law once it's been passed by the House and also by the Senate, but he can't.
Right.
I mean, he can suggest them, but he, you know, his legally, his suggestions carry no more weight than yours or mine.
Why are we being held hostage by the bankers?
Because they've got all the money. You have six banks in the United States. You have five banks in the United States that hold 65% of the total GDP of the United States.
And we are afraid. We seem to be
afraid,
the American people,
Yeah, no, and I'm with you. This is why I want, there's a petition out there. Michael, thank you for the call. There's a petition out there to have Elizabeth Warren put on the Senate Banking Committee. And this is something that I think is so important. Elizabeth Warren, I mean, there's nobody in Congress who understands the banking business better than Elizabeth Warren. She taught this topic in college. She was a regulator of banks. She helped create the Consumer Protection Financial Protection Bureau. And now she's the senator from Massachusetts. And Harry Reid should put her on the Senate Banking Committee tomorrow morning. Well, he can't do it tomorrow morning. He can't do it until after the first of the year when she's sworn into office. But as soon as 30 seconds after she's sworn into office, she should be on the Senate Banking Committee. Because she is going to take names and kick butt. She understands what's going on out there. And I think that she will empower a number of other progressive senators and maybe even pick up some conservatives who realize that this rush to deregulation that started with Jimmy Carter imitating Margaret Thatcher in 78, went on steroids with Ronald Reagan in the 80s, and still is with us to this day, that this rush to deregulation has been very, very destructive to the United States. That when the soft money was allowed back in the 90s, which led to, you know, Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act and ending Glass-Steagall and all that stuff, that was very destructive to the United States. Elizabeth Warren gets it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in fact, I mean, everybody's talking about Hillary in 2016. Hillary's fine with me, but I think Elizabeth Warren would make a great president. Minutes before the hour, Colin in Barrington, Illinois, you're listening to WCPT. Colin, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air. What's up?
Oh, yes. Thank you for having me, Tom. I actually just discovered your program only a couple weeks ago, and it was certainly much nicer to listen to than WIND.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yes, I was actually calling about the gentleman you had on a little earlier in the hour who had that book about same-sex marriage.
Right.
I thought I had some a 2 cents to put in there since I'm a child of same-sex parents.
Okay. Tell us. Okay. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thought was I actually just got a history. I'm fresh out of college with my degree in history, and I always like how people say that marriage was an institution that has always been between a man and a woman, and it's always been about procreation. They never think about, well, for instance, there actually was same-sex marriage 2,000 years ago in the Roman Empire. Even had satires of Juvenal complaining that he had to go to a wedding with two men, and all I thought while reading it was, wow, people really do complain about the same things.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, and in fact, it was not uncommon in Greece as well during the Greek democracy 3,000 years ago. Absolutely right. Plus, you know, people say, well, we want a traditional biblical definition of marriage. Oh, is that like David with, 700 wives? Or, you know, I mean, or is that like, you know, with concubines? I mean, you know, it's like, traditional marriage, give me a break. Every generation redefines marriage. You know, traditional marriage was the argument that was made in the 60s when there were states that made it illegal for people of different races to marry each other, the miscegenation laws. They say, oh, we got to uphold traditional marriage, you know, just white people marrying white people and black people marrying black people. Come on. It's,
well,
it's like, you know,
ironic about that. My, my mother, my birth mother is a very conservative, fiscal conservative, voted for Romney, and she's white, and her wife is a black pagan liberal that voted for Obama.
Oh my goodness. You really grew up in a blended household.
It is quite a blended household. Me and my little brother, actually. And unfortunately, well, we live in Illinois right now, and they do have the civil union laws. But unfortunately, right. The civil union laws is kind of a toothless tiger in the sense of, because technically the Defense of Marriage Act is still in place. The federal government doesn't recognize their marriage. And to have my brother, I mean, they spend thousands of dollars in legal fees just to have some of the same legal and tax rights that, you know, that a man and a woman, they can get married, you know, at any chapel in 2 seconds, just like that. And they have the same things that my parents have been fighting for years and legal red tape. It's deplorable.
Yep. I'm totally with you, Colin. Thank you for calling and sharing your story. And as the child of a same-sex couple, good on you for calling up and having the courage to speak out. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. And thanks for listening to WCPT. Charles, listening on Sirius XM in Indian Trail, North Carolina. Charles, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. As a recovering school teacher, I thought I should add in that I know the states that were the perverse sisters, as they were sometimes called in the Continental Congress.
Oh, who did not vote to ratify the Constitution? What were they?
Well, New York was number 10. Virginia was number 11. New York waited until the ninth vote was in before Hamilton could get his people organized to do it. Virginia did it because Hamilton sent a letter to John Jay saying that they were going to put in those, what we now know as the Bill of Rights to add in. So that swung the vote over that way.
Right.
Then
Jefferson was lobbying on that one.
Georgia and Rhode Island. They always, whenever the old Articles of Confederation Congress needed to have a unanimous vote, either Georgia or Rhode Island voted against it.
Huh.
Well, they both initially voted against it. Georgia then went in as state number 12.
Okay.
Rhode Island stayed out of it until they were going to put tariffs on Rhode Island because they were going to treat it like a foreign country at that point. And Rhode Island, by a very narrow margin, voted to enter into the Constitution and become the 13th state.
Very interesting. Charles, thank you for, I got to tell you, we have the smartest listeners of any program out there. I so appreciate it. Charles, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing that with us. Ralph in Rochester, New York. Hey, Ralph, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm hoping I'm not going to throw off the curve on that smart listener thing, but I'm going to do my best. The comments about Romney and saying, well, the only reason President Obama won re-election was because he was giving his supporters gifts. And then O'Reilly said the same thing on Fox, said stuff.
Right.
They want stuff. They want things. And as you rightly pointed out, you know, things like health care that are basic human rights.
Yes.
But it's the conservative way. And every time I try to look at a different issue and look at the conservative viewpoint to try to understand it, it always comes down to a profit motive or a property rights.
Well, there's a certain amount of oligarchy mixed in there, too. There's a certain sense among the Romney-level rich, people who are born with more than $1 million, the Donald Trumps of the world, that they are morally and genetically superior to the rest of us.
Well, think about it as well, the gun rights issue. And I don't see a lot of the very wealthy, you know, out there pounding that drum, but whenever you talk to someone who is, you know, Second Amendment all the way and, you know, you're not going to get my guns, the argument is always, well, how do I protect my home, my property?
Right.
And, you know, I used to run a small supermarket, and the owners always told us, look, someone comes in and wants to rob you, let them take it because we don't want anyone getting hurt. We'd rather lose everything, all the material goods, than lose an employee, have someone get killed.
Yeah, more people die from guns, either in suicide or gun accidents, than save themselves using guns in the United States. Those stats are pretty solid. Ralph, thank you very much for the call. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Harmon Program, it's Friday. That means it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be here talking about the important issues of the week and taking your calls, too. Plus, anything goes on Town Hall Friday. What's on your mind this week? And don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. It takes action. Go to movetoamend.org. Go to pdamerica.org. Tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.